Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden, and joining me tonight as tonight's co-host, NBC legal and political analyst, Dean Johnson. Tonight, we cover a topic that is close to our hearts, animals. Dean?
Good evening, everyone. It's great to be back. And full disclosure, as we go into this program, Jeff and I are very excited about this show tonight because one thing Jeff and I share is our love of animals. Both of us have worked pro bono on cases involving animal protection, and neither of us accepts cases in which the client is charged with animal abuse. Sharing the world with our furry, feathered, and scale friends creates a web of legal rights and responsibilities. And there's a growing movement that contends that animals themselves may have legal rights. So tonight, our panel of outstanding guests will help us illuminate our relationship with animals, whether pets, animals raised for food, or those wild animals who occupy our environment. Jeffrey?
And as you can hear, there's much to discuss. And as an added bonus, you might have heard about the Parrots of Telegraph Hill. Tonight, the sequel. You'll hear about the Geese of Foster City. But again, we want you to join us, our most important guest. Our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And bear in mind that our guests are here to educate, to inform, perhaps entertain, but they can't provide legal advice. The opinions that are expressed here tonight don't necessarily reflect the opinions of their employers or clients or KALW. Again, you have our phone number here, 415-841-4134. And as always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. You want to talk about our relationship with animals. You want to talk about animal rights. You don't have to jump in at the same point we may be in our conversation. Dean, why don't you get us started? Who else is with us tonight?
Oh, we have some fantastic guests tonight. Our first guest is Laura Toler Gardner. Laura is a leader in the area of animal welfare. She serves as chief executive officer of Pets in Need, an animal shelter and adoption facility based in Redwood City and Palo Alto. Ms. Toler Gardner collaborates with directors of Shelter Medicine, Shelter Operations Finance, and programs to strengthen Pets in Need's operations, and works towards ending pet homelessness in Redwood City and Palo Alto.
Also joining us, Dr. Barry Kipperman is a veterinary specialist in animal welfare and a lecturer in veterinary ethics at UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. Barry is the co-author and co-editor of the book Ethics in Veterinary Practice, published in 2022. Dr. Kipperman also serves on the Animal Welfare Committee of the California Veterinary Medical Association, the board of directors of the Humane Society Veterinary Medical Association, and Mighty Vet, an organization dedicated to wellness in the profession of veterinary medicine.
And of course, any discussion is made richer when we include Brent Turner. Brent is a graduate of Lincoln Law School in San Francisco with a degree granted by the University of San Francisco in International Legal Studies from Oxford, England. A community activist, Brent is the go-to person when discussing election issues. But tonight, Mr. Turner has an interesting issue involving a local community and birds that it considered to be a nuisance. Brent was recently featured in the award-winning reform documentary, The Real Activist, with former CIA Director Jim Woolsey and Peter Coyote.
Without further ado, let me welcome all of you. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
So, as our listeners know, when I'm here, I like to open with a big question. And my big question tonight is one that I'm very personally interested in hearing a discussion about, because I've frankly wrestled with this myself for a long time. Whenever I think about the phrase ethical treatment of animals, I always run into paradoxes. For example, we all love dogs. We all care for dogs and cats. But sheep are cute and intelligent and lovable too, but we factory farm them and we slaughter them for meat, sometimes to feed our dogs. You know, we might, every one of us, all of us humans, go vegan, but the animals that we love and care for, some of them are carnivores. The pet food industry is one of the biggest contributors to the slaughter of animals for food. So can we talk coherently about the ethical treatment of animals? Is it possible to treat all animals ethically? And I'm sure you can hear the air quotes around ethically. And if we can, I mean, what would a program of ethical treatment of all animals look like? And I throw that out to Barry, to Laura, to Brent, and to anybody else who wants to chime in on the answer.
Barry, before we went on air tonight, you discussed a book that had almost that verbatim as the title.
Sure, Jeff, I'd be happy to share that. So there's an awesome book by Hal Herzog, who is a anthrozoologist. And the title of his book is Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat: Why It's So Hard to Think Straight About Animals. And I think, you know, when I think about, you know, the questions that were just posed, you know, can we talk coherently about the ethical treatment of animals? You know, the reality is that as human beings, we run the show, we make the decisions, and all of the animals under our care are dependent on human beings. So consequently, when conflicts of interest arise between the interests of humans and the interests of animals, it's only logical that most of the time, anthropocentrism, that is, human interests, are going to prevail.
But is it as simple as saying there's a hierarchy of which ones we value more and therefore we treat some animals better than others?
I think, for example, animal advocates know quite well that, for example, animals are used to test pesticides to make sure that pesticides are safe prior to their distribution to human beings. And if those pesticides are tested on rodents, there's very little public outcry. But if those pesticides are tested on beagles, there is more significant public outcry. And in fact, laws have been created now in the state of California to abrogate the use of dogs to test pesticides. But one could argue that rodents are equally as sentient and capable of experiencing negative experiences as dogs.
Laura, you have a look on your face like you're ready to jump in on this. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think that we need to meet people where they're at. And the positive thing that we experience in the animal welfare community is that the human-animal bond is not only good for animals, it's good for people. It's good for mental health, physical health, for both people and animals. And our hope is that by being in relationship with animals that we consider pets, it broadens sort of the human consciousness and the human understanding, and creates a softness and a greater receptivity to other animals. That is our hope. And we see that over sort of a long arc of time. But we think that you start where people are and you start with the animals that they can engage with most frequently, and then you sort of build there.
And of course, we're living in a time when everybody's dog is a service animal.
Yeah. My wife, Linda, and I often joke we have an emotional support dog at home. He's a dog that needs a lot of emotional support, and we are his emotional support humans. But, you know, I think the problems go deeper. I think I agree with everything that Laura said, but as you were saying, Barry, we really have two ways of looking at animals. On the one hand, we have that human-animal bond, and they are our companions. They're members of our family. On the other hand, legally speaking, dogs, cats, our companion animals are considered property. And we sort of hold both of those concepts in our mind. I mean, it would be legally, if we went into court, the dog is property. If we showed up at the vet's office and the vet said, well, good afternoon, Mr. Johnson, how's your property today? We would think that was utterly inappropriate, right?
We would.
Exactly. It's an antithetical position for us as society. And, you know, when I discuss with my veterinary students that, you know, animals are property, you know, they're mortified. But, you know, it's a delicate issue. And I'm certainly, you know, don't come from it from the legal perspective. But, you know, it's my understanding that when animals were declared property as a carryover from English common law, those laws were meant to protect the property owners of animals. And the most valuable animals at the time those laws were created were horses then used for transportation and livestock that were used for milk and for food. So, you know, I would argue that the present property status of animals does a better job protecting human beings than it does protecting animals.
But doesn't that also beg the question, if the paradigm were to change and we recognize animals as having some inherent rights, I would think that their rights would yield more often than if it's my property and I can protect them. But if it really is my property that I'm protecting, if I'm protecting my property, does that mean that if a mountain lion comes into my yard, before it goes after my dog or my cat, I could kill the mountain lion? Or is it somewhat fluid whether they're property or whether they're considered beings?
Yeah, that's a great point. I don't know how we resolve this paradox. You know, I think some have proposed perhaps upgrading the law and making animals, quote, sentient property to distinguish them from a coffee table or a couch, legally speaking. But, you know, I think all of us in this room recognize, of course, that animals are sentient feeling creatures and that, you know, and that the law treating them as property is somewhat archaic.
Yeah, and is just on a very practical level, isn't the property paradigm slipping? I know that Ecuador now recognizes animal rights. The UK, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, has an Animal Welfare Act that protects animals a lot more strongly than we do here in this country. And I think you've talked about even some large corporations are now getting into the act and refusing to put vendors who engage in forms of animal cruelty in their supply chains, yes?
That's very true. I was recently reading a flyer that was somewhat disturbing, indicating, for example, that when you're raising chickens, whether it be for slaughter or whether it be for egg production, they tend to smother, or worse, the young male chicks that are killed almost instantly. It's all part of a supply chain and where there's demand.
Yeah, and Barry, I think you've talked about, mentioned in some of your articles, what I had never heard of before, things called gestation crates, right?
Right.
Yeah, so, tell us about that a little bit, because I don't think people know what's actually going on out there, and it might be good to educate.
So pigs have been proven to be very smart animals and are equally trainable as dogs are. And for people who have companion pigs, they would certainly vouch for that reality.
And I've heard pigs described as big pink puppies.
But yet, the way we industrially raise pigs is that mother pigs, who are viewed as a precious commodity, of course, because they're, you know, they're harboring the future pigs on the farm, in order to ensure that those future piglets are not harmed, about 75% of mother pigs in the United States are housed in gestation crates, which are 2-foot by 7-foot crates where the pregnant sow can not turn around or stand up or lie down comfortably. And she is forced to stay in that crate for about her entire 115-day gestation period until she gives birth. And for, you know, for most people who care about animals to view that, it's a complete violation of the notion that these are intelligent animals who are being kept that way. But the reality is that it's an economic issue. These pigs are valuable, and their future piglets are seen as valuable. And there are about a dozen states, including California, that have outlawed pigs in gestation crates, but it's still a significant animal welfare concern.
And there are a number of corporations that have simply cut the farmers who use gestation crates out of their supply chains, yes?
Correct. So there is absolutely a trend, certainly within large retailers, there is certainly a trend now. The biggest trend is getting laying hens out of cages. That trend is happening exponentially quickly. But so getting sows out of gestation crates is turning out to be a little more difficult. But I think that, you know, the future, it's difficult for me to see a future where the public envisages that sort of treatment for pigs.
You know, I'd like to bring Laura especially into this discussion. I know you've written a lot about adoption standards and standards for rescue, foster, animal shelters. So could you talk about that? And Laura, I'd like to have you talk about what Pets in Need does in terms of some of these standards, because I think you're right along the lines of what Dr. Kupperman's been recommending.
Thank you. So Pets in Need is celebrating our 60th anniversary this year, which is very exciting. So we've been saving lives since 65, which is terrific. Pets in Need is a socially conscious rescue organization that runs 2 shelters in Palo Alto and Redwood City. And basically, we really engage the community to be partners in the life-saving activities for pets. And what that looks like is engaging the community at all levels of our operation as volunteers, as fosters, and as real advocates and helpers in the saving of animals. It really does take a village to save animals. So sort of what we're talking about is sheltering has evolved in a way that really recognizes that the most important thing is connecting animals and people. And we look to develop resources to be able to do that to the greatest of our ability. And obviously, as a nonprofit, most shelters, whether they're nonprofits or municipal shelters, have limited resources. So the way that you really bring resources to bear is by engaging the community very actively in the actual daily life saving of animals. And we think that when we do that, it starts to change community perception and community attitudes around animals. And so that has been what Pets in Need has been doing for 60 years. Pets in Need was a pioneer 60 years ago when it was founded. Really, our founders understood the human-animal bond, even though science hadn't yet been able to prove that. And they understood that animals had an opportunity to save people and people save animals. And so the idea of just taking animals in and killing them because there wasn't enough space for them was really anathema to our founders, as it was to the founders of most organizations.
I'm sure a lot of our listeners don't know about the difference between kill and no-kill shelters. Tell us a little bit. Pets in Need is a no-kill shelter.
We are.
And that hasn't been the kind of shelter that we've seen in past years. Tell us a little bit about how that evolved and how that worked.
Sure. So Pets in Need was founded as a no-kill shelter. And a lot of people are familiar with the organization Best Friends. Best Friends, many years ago, established sort of a benchmark and said that if 90% of animals in a shelter are saved and adopted out, you're a no-kill shelter. Now, I want to be really clear. No one who goes into sheltering is there for any other reason than to rescue animals. No one wants to kill an animal in a shelter or anywhere else. So we are adapting in our understanding of this, and we no longer use no-kill quite as we did. We now talk about socially responsible sheltering, socially conscious sheltering, and we recognize that those of us with greater resources support shelters who have fewer resources. So the idea of rescue and transferring animals between shelters has been working for decades, and it's very, very popular now, and you're only going to see more of it because that's how we're going to get the most number of animals saved. So at Pets in Need, we have a 97% save rate, which we're extraordinarily proud of. And we do that not only by taking animals in from our immediate community, but supporting our sister shelters in other locations that don't have the same resources, that are much more impacted. We transfer their animals to us, and they then have more space to deal with the animals they have, and we can offset and we can save a lot of lives that otherwise wouldn't have been.
Yeah, and there's a lot more to this than just getting a home, quote unquote, for the animal. I know you do a lot in terms of setting up programs so that people who may not have the wherewithal to take a dog or a cat can get what they need in terms of veterinary services, food, and so on.
Absolutely. In the sheltering world, we understand that as access to care. And the more access to care there is, the better. The idea behind access to care is that animals deserve to be with families, and families deserve to have animals. And the sheltering and rescue world shows up to provide as much resource as we possibly can to keep animals with their families. So if a family is going through an economic hardship or a housing hardship, we provide veterinary service, we provide food service, we provide behavior service to allow folks to keep their animals with them. And that then we divert animals that don't then have to come into shelters.
And just let's do a shameless plug here. Am I correct in assuming that the Pets in Need and other shelters are going to be inundated when wildfire season starts, or at least we're expecting that? Yes.
You know, the fire season over the last several years has been very tough on animals. And yes, shelters and rescues have stepped up and will continue to step up with the LA fires. All of California shelters really did an incredible lift and brought in thousands of animals, which was terrific. So yes, so we are preparing, and equally importantly is we are deep in kitten and puppy season.
Uh-oh.
Yes, absolutely. So the importance of adoption can't be understated, and the importance of spay and neuter cannot be understated.
All right, you heard it there, ladies and gentlemen. Pets in Need is knee-deep in kittens and puppies. So if you want a kitten or a puppy, if you want to take one of these companion animals into your home, or if you want to foster, how do they go about that?
Yes. Fostering is so vitally important, and foster homes are just worth their weight in gold. So we are available at petsinneed.org, petsinneed.org. Everything you need to know to foster, adopt, volunteer, donate is there. And if we are not your local shelter, please take a look online for your local shelter, because I guarantee you they have great puppies and kittens as well, and I'm sure they have fantastic opportunities for you to support in all kinds of ways.
There was a shelter, I'm not going to mention where or mention it by name, but there was a shelter that was known to say that they don't kill adoptable animals.
Okay.
But then internally, they're reputed to have defined whether they're adoptable by how long they had them, which is somewhat circular. Is that something that people are moving away from now, hopefully?
Yes. I think that, you know, socially conscious shelters and those who are doing the best they have with the resources that they have are really not euthanizing for time or space. That's not always easy to do, especially if you are in a location where you have really heavy impact and very, 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 very low resource availability. But that's where partnership really comes in handy and is serving a lot of animals and a lot of organizations. That's why rescue and transfer and transports are so important.
One of the areas I want to touch on with you after the break is the example of the influx of animals after the wildfires. I was reading about that earlier today. I was reading your press releases where you talked about animals being brought in from Southern California, also from the Central Valley. And again, that's the partnering that you've been doing.
Yes. Yeah. It's been terrific. And Pets in Need definitely stepped up, but all of our sister shelters did. And basically, you know, when the call comes, you show up. And so there were organizations that flew animals from Southern California to Northern California, and a lot of organizations that drove animals. And the County of LA did a really, really good job under very, very difficult circumstances. And I'm very proud to say that Northern California shelters went above and beyond.
Did we keep track of not only what percentage of those animals got placed or fostered, but how many of them were reunited with their original families?
So the County of LA was very, very careful, and they did not transfer out any animals that were immediately that were specifically impacted by fire. They put a 90-day moratorium on their stray hold so that animals could be, hopefully, over that 90 days, be reunited with their families. So the animals that came out of LA and came out of Southern California were all the animals that were in shelters before the fires started. So they cleaned out those shelters, sent all those animals elsewhere, so that then they could fill the shelters with all of the fire victims.
So one hopes your dog didn't get out a week before the fires, or they might be relocated.
Correct. Yeah.
But thankfully, not to El Salvador.
We spend lots of money to make that happen, but you're previewing next week's show. Ladies and gentlemen, next week, we have some phenomenal guests. We're going to be talking about immigration. We're going to be talking about resources available to communities that right now are under siege. There are nationwide networks being set up to have people springing into action to give immediate relief, get lawyers to people right away when we found out someone's been detained, have people waiting when they get moved to detention centers around the country. There are some phenomenal things going. And as always, you can hear about it here. We can give you resources. There are nationwide numbers you can call to get people to spring into action. We'll talk about that next week. That's next week's show.
A very important topic.
Thank you, Mr. President. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Jeff Hayden. Joining me in the studio tonight, tonight's co-host, Dean Johnson. We're discussing our relationship with animals with Pets in Need Chief Executive Officer Laura Toler-Garner, veterinary specialist in animal welfare, Dr. Barry Kipperman, and Brent Turner, the real activist. If you have questions for our guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. And as always, you can call regarding any topic, anything on tonight's topic, our relationship with animals. You don't have to join the exact moment we may be in our conversation. You're listening to Your Legal Rights. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
So I mentioned this at the beginning of the broadcast. Many of you have seen the film or heard the stories of the Parrots of Telegraph Hill. Tonight, we're going to talk about a sequel to the story, maybe one that's not as warm and fuzzy, but we're going to talk about the geese in Foster City. Brent, you want to tell us that story?
Well, Jeff, and thanks to the guests for showing up tonight and dealing with these important matters on a daily basis, and we salute you for that. So I was in my office and doing my election system reform work and listening to the television set in the background and heard a story about the city of Foster City having a problem with the Canadian geese. And their proposed remedy was to snap the necks of the geese. So when I heard that, I just kept working and sort of dawned on me, I absorbed it maybe 20, 30 minutes later, did I just hear what I thought I heard? And I thought to myself, they're not snapping those necks of those geese while I'm on duty in San Mateo County where I live. So got together with some local politicos, David Canepa, the president of the San Mateo County Board of Supervisors, and many others, and some animal rescue groups that are nationally known, one out of San Rafael that I'm sure my guests are familiar with, and animal protection. And there was a concerted effort to appear before the city council in Foster City. And we brought enough attention to the matter with the local media and the local politicians that we put the kibosh on their efforts to snap the necks of the geese. And we did it by basically just highlighting the issue and guilting them into submission, because the thought that that's how you deal with a problem and the message that it sends to the children, that if something is an irritant that you snap its neck, it just resonated with the public, and it got through to the city council. So up until this moment, we've managed to keep them at bay, but pun intended. But the issue still persists, and so we're ever watchful and making sure that in the Bay Area, if we encounter something that isn't exactly to our liking with goose poop or whatever, we don't snap necks. We think of other alternative remedies. So that was a successful effort.
So, Brent, what do people need to do if they want to save the geese?
Well, I think at this point in Foster City, it's like I say, we're managing to keep the murder option off the table, and that's what I coined it, the murder option. I proposed fictitiously just to say, hey, let's make it a field trip. If you really want to do this, Foster City, and send this message to the children, let's bring them out there to witness it live. Of course, that shocked them enough that my point was made. But right now, I think there's a good city council there, but we have to be attentive to it, because they'll backslide and you know, they have vendors coming at them that would love that job. By the way, for everybody's education, the alternative, if you try to snap the goose's neck, which mostly they do toward the mothers that are stagnant because of their birth cycles, if they don't snap the neck easily, then they put them in little Auschwitz-style ovens, literally, that then anesthetize or kill the goose. So, you know, when I heard about these options, I was shocked, because I wasn't familiar with any of this, and that's what happened. But at least Foster City, for now, is on the higher ground.
Now, hold on. You say there are vendors who are willing to come and do this? Dude?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Professional gooseneck snappers?
Correct. And I don't know if they have a relationship with somebody on the council, but you know, we got into that conversation regarding vendors and inappropriate persuasion.
But for now, Foster City is a sanctuary city for the Canadian geese.
I think so, but the geese are always at issue, and they tend to migrate around. By the way, snapping their necks does absolutely nothing to address the problem. It just sometimes moves the problem next door, but then they come right back because, of course, there's no way to control their patterns.
Well, that's great. I'm glad you jumped in on that.
Thanks to David Canepa, President Canepa of the board, for stepping up and giving it some attention. Yeah, that was helpful.
Those geese are magnificent.
Were there
animals.
A few people in Foster City and the city council that were particularly receptive? We don't necessarily need to list all the ones who were not, but people that were.
There were. The majority of the board was receptive and turned around, which was interesting because. You know, that's is an activist. That's not always that's not always the way it goes. But luckily in Foster City, they were well-thought, compassionate people that put the geese before the people that were complaining about the goose poop. Basically, it was people on athletic fields. So, you know, what we said was, hey, maybe give some folks that need a job something to do and clean up the poop that way.
Clean up the goose poop.
Yeah, there you
go.
Let me turn it to Barry. I want to take a step back from some of these specifics and just ask you in a more general way, how did you get from going from being a licensed veterinarian to becoming an expert on such a niche area as animal ethics and teaching veterinary students about animal ethics?
Thanks, Jeff. Well, for the first portion of my career, probably like many colleagues, you know, my focus was on mastering medicine and communicating well with my clients and taking good care of my patients. And at some point, maybe a decade into my career, when I felt that I kind of had that mastered, then I suddenly, my television screen became filled with all of these ethical conundrums that I had no room for in the first decade of my practice. So, for example, some common ethical conundrums particularly occur when the interests of the human client and the animal patient are in conflict, and the veterinarian is sometimes the one stuck in the middle. So, for example, an unfortunate and common circumstance that veterinarians and animals find themselves in is when an animal may have a treatable condition, for example, requiring a major surgery, but the family cannot afford the thousands of dollars that are needed to get through that major surgery. And I began to ask myself, you know, what is my role as a veterinarian here? What is my role as a practice owner? Is it my obligation to divert my own personal resources to help my patients in these sorts of circumstances? Conversely, we talked about the human-animal bond at the start of the show. And one drawback of the human-animal bond is that some animals who are dying and who are suffering, because of the strength of the human-animal bond, the animal owner is unwilling to part with them or let them go and requires continued ongoing treatment from a veterinarian. So these sorts of ethical conundrums began to weigh on me personally, and I thought I can't be the only one going through these things. And so I recognized that there was a need for a textbook and for education so that veterinarians and veterinary students would have an opportunity to think about these sorts of problems before they actually experience them. I also would like to outline, if we go back to the pigs in the gestation crates. So science, for example, may guide us that putting pigs in gestation crates is economically best for a farm. So science tells us what we can do regarding animals, laws tell us what we must do regarding animals, and ethics focuses on the question of what we should do regarding animals. And that's what makes ethics so fascinating to me.
So, do you spend more of your time in practice or lecturing, writing? You've written books on the subject as well?
Yeah, I retired from clinical practice with the onset of the pandemic. So now I'm committed to writing and speaking and teaching. And just trying to give my students the benefit of my 33 years of experience in clinical practice and trying to help them and give them tools for both recognizing and being able to address the ethical conflicts that they're likely to encounter as veterinarians.
So let me ask a question, and maybe we can close out the show with this discussion. And yes, this is a foreshadowing of next week's show. We find ourselves now in a position where we're seeing rights being taken away from human beings. Are we moving in a direction where rights may be, or more rights may be given to animals, or where animal welfare and ethical treatment of animals is being taken more seriously? And if so, what direction should we take? What needs to be done? And I put this out to Barry, to Laura, to Brent, and to anybody else who wants to respond. Barry, what do you think? Where are we going, and where should we go with the ethical treatment of animals?
I think that there is more interest in the ethical treatment of animals now than ever before. When I was a kid, there were never articles in the New York Times about how we should treat pigs. But now Nicholas Kristof has written numerous essays published in the New York Times about perhaps the moral hypocrisy of the way we treat farm animals compared to the way we treat companion animals. And I think that, you know, one of the lessons we learned from Brent's story about the geese is that there's something known as the social consensus ethic, which means that when our treatment of animals, when society is not aligned with our present treatment of animals, then that force that society can bring, whether it's on calling retailers to pressure them to treat animals in their supply chains better, whether it's, you know, Brent's threat that, hey, you know, we're gonna publicize this to the community, and this is not going to be a good look for Foster City. So I think that there's more, you know, as the human-animal bond increases steadily, you know, with the work of, you know, animal rescue and people like Laura who are committed to furthering the human-animal bond, you know, I think that there is a logarithmic extrapolation that our treatment of animals is going to follow. And there's going to be, you know, again, when I was a kid, there were elephants in the circus. Elephants are smart animals, and they're no longer in the circus. So things are changing for all animal species, and it's society's perceptions of the social consensus ethic that are contributing to those changes.
You know, also, I heard a good piece today regarding empathy and the issue of empathy in the United States. I don't know who exactly was speaking about it, but it was well detailed regarding our lack of empathy. And I think the way we treat animals is very reflective of society. So I am hopeful that it gets better, but I have concerns.
It is my hope that we are on an upswing. I think that we see in the circumstances of crises with animals, there is a huge outpouring and groundswell. And that hopefully is an indicator of where sort of animals are held in our collective consciousness as a society, and where we're going. There's still a long way to go. There's still a long way to go. But the more that we embrace one another's work and recognize that every step forward is a significant one, I think we're making good progress.
I'm deeply concerned. You know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt had a dog named Falla. Mm. Richard Nixon had a dog named Checkers. Bill Clinton, every time he got off of Marine One in the Rose Garden, his dog, his chocolate lab buddy, came up wagging his tail like crazy. And now we have a president who doesn't have a pet. And I think, you know, I don't know about other people, but I judge people a lot by the way they treat their animal companions. And the people who are good and kind to their animal companions, I think, have that empathy. And the people who don't have animal companions, I tend to think, lack that empathy. And that
I wouldn't take it quite that far, or you might get into that issue about people that don't have children, whether they have the same standing. But I will say that
and our Democratic cat ladies, and yeah.
Well, there was the one lady working for Trump that I think he appointed that didn't she take the dog, the puppy out in the backyard and shot it in the head? I think.
Christine.
So that tells you where we are with that administration.
Yeah, and it tells you where the divides lie. I mean, we have people like Brent Turner out there saving the geese, and we have people like Christy Noem shooting the dog. Yet another divide here in our American polity.
But that's also something that's more typical of what you would see in a rural area where they deal more with farm animals than more in the cities where we have companion animals, animals that are close to us and animals that we think of as fulfilling a need or a niche in the food chain, not really something we grew up with.
That's what Christy said. Yeah.
But it does.
I think we stipulate dogs. Dogs are on our team, right?
They're on our side, yeah.
It does beg the question. On the one hand, we think of animals as property. On the other hand, there are companion animals. Where does that leave the wildlife? What if a coyote shows up in my yard or is trying to come in my open door? What are my rights to protect my property? Do they end with the fact that it's an animal that we're supposed to protect in the cities, that now they're favored? Or do I get to say, no, my house, my pets, my property, my mess to clean up afterwards? I mean, where do we go with that? Barry, do you have any sense of that?
You know, wildlife are tough because they're not directly under human supervision the way farm animals are and companion animals are. So I would argue, you know, we don't have a direct obligation to help them, but we do have an obligation to not intentionally cause them harm. So for example, you know, coyote contests, wildlife killing contests. You know, I find these things, you know, revolting. But, you know, certainly I think most people could understand that if a coyote is in your yard threatening your poodle, you certainly have a right to prioritize your poodle, who is considered a family member. But yes, they're both sentient animals, and that's a tricky one to navigate.
Yeah, you know, John Stuart Mill made a very useful distinction back in the 19th century between perfect and imperfect obligations. Imperfect obligations are things we should do, like contributing to charity, and that make us better. Perfect obligations are the things that we must do. And what I hear you saying, Barry, tell me if I'm wrong, is that, you know, what we owe to animals is what makes us better people, makes us more empathetic, which something that strengthens that bond between animals and human beings. But where we get into trouble is the idea that there's something mandatory that we must do towards animals. What do you think about that distinction?
That's where the law comes in. So yeah. Laws dictate what we must do.
Yeah.
But ethics probably is a much larger field, and that dictates what we should do. Now, you know, Laura talked about the human-animal bond and its benefits for animals and people. The opposite extreme is that there is something known as the link that has been well known for a long time, and that is that people who abuse animals are often violent to women and children, and that there is this link that the FBI is quite aware of. So the reality is that, yes, those of us who are kinder to animals, on average, are likely going to be kinder and more empathic towards human beings and vice versa. So there's a lot to be gained for kindness to animals, not just for animals, but for human civilization.
And on the other side of that, the link has been shown with the people that commit monstrous crimes against individuals and how so many of them started with cruelty to animals.
Yeah, when I was a homicide prosecutor, I was trained by an FBI profiler. And one thing she told us is that every serial killer she'd ever run into started with being cruel to animals and then evolved into cruelty towards people.
We got to come up with something new. We can't end on a note like that.
Well, we'll do better than that.
Does anybody know a little bit about what's happening abroad? I know in other countries they've passed a right to nature law in Panama and Mexico City. What are they doing? Ecuador's officially recognized animal rights. Mm-hmm. Have we heard more about recent movements abroad in that direction?
Yeah, the UK has an animal welfare law that is very broad and that essentially requires citizens who take on a companion animal to provide certain needs. And there's even, I think Barry is a lot more expert in this than I am, but as I understand it, if you take on a companion animal under the animal welfare law and you don't provide what's needed for the animal, you can actually be prosecuted.
Exactly, and that's so. Here in the United Kingdom, that law establishes positive duties that one must provide their animal in alignment with what is known as the five freedoms. In the United States, there is no such law mandating positive duties to animals. The law is you cannot commit cruelty. So I think that the UK law is a step in the right direction. I would love to see that. You know, going back to the question, I believe the European Union recently established cephalopods as sentient beings in the hope of thwarting octopus farming in the European Union.
And from what I've seen, those are surprisingly intelligent and alert creatures.
You know, that I mean, pretty soon it's going to be documented that insects are sentient feeling creatures. And then, you know, where does that leave us when, you know, when there are flies in my house?
In a pile of doo-doo.
Well, having worked with beekeepers and having seen the remarkable behavior of bee colonies, I think I might get behind that.
There's always natural ways of dealing with things in order to preserve the natural order. There are plants that are alert enough to keep the excessive insect population down. They're a little scary looking, but we do have those access. You know, we basically run out of time. I did promise our guests time for last closing remarks that anybody has. Let me start with you, Laura.
Thank you. You know, I would just really encourage all of us to think about the animals in our communities, the animals that we live with or we see or come in contact with on a semi-regular basis. And just as many of our guests today have talked about, lead with some empathy. It not only is good for the animals, it's good for us. And if you have the inclination to spend some time to benefit animals, please do it. It will mean everything in the life of an animal. So if you can volunteer, if you can foster, if you can adopt, because it is busy and it's summer season and we have a lot of animals and all the shelters, please do so. And you know, the reality is too, if you can write a check, you are also going to be saving animals. So please do what you can. It's good for animals, but it's also going to be really good for you too.
And let me turn it to Brent.
Well, thank you, Jeff, and thanks for another great show on these kinds of issues that I think are of great interest to especially people in the Bay Area that want to know what's going on in our own backyard. And thank you for having these shelters in Redwood City and in Palo Alto. Great work. I want to be further involved. And again, thanks to the show here, KALW, for hosting and putting forth good information to the public. And finally, let's close by saying the empathy thing. Yeah, it works with humans and it works with animals.
And Barry, I'd like to give you some time for any final remarks.
Thank you, Jeff, for the opportunity to participate tonight. I would like to remind here that the words animal welfare, welfare derives from the words to fare well. And so when we think about the concept of animal welfare, poor welfare is really no welfare at all because an animal's not faring well. So it's important when we think about the concept of animal welfare that we think about it from the perspective of the animal and not from the perspective of the animal's utility to human beings.
Dean, would you like to take about a half a minute?
Just very quickly, you know, the phrase ethical conundrum came up a lot. There is a lot of work to be done here, a massive amount of intellectual work and practical work. And I hope that someday we are at the point where we see all animals as companions that deserve to be loved and cared for. But along the way, we could at least get to the baseline and eliminate homelessness, cruelty, and starvation. And while we're doing it for animals, maybe we should do it for human beings as well.
How do I follow up a message like that? You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight, we revisited our discussion of ethics and animals. Our guests tonight have been Pets in Need Chief Executive Officer Laura Tolner-Gardner, Veterinary Specialist in Animal Welfare Dr. Barry Kipperman, and Brent Turner, the Real Activist. Also joining me tonight as co-host, NBC legal and political analyst Gene Johnson. Our show tonight's been produced by Dean Johnson and yours truly. Next week is another special show. We're focusing on immigration. With communities throughout the Bay Area and, in fact, throughout the state and the country under siege, we're here to talk about resources, help, networks, phone numbers. Best of all, we take your calls and answer your questions right here at Your Legal Rights. That's Wednesday at 6 o'clock. Thanks again to all of our guests, and our thanks to all of you for joining us. For Dean Johnson and at the controls, for Joanne Marr, the marvelous Marla Davies, I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night, be safe, and zealously guard your legal rights.